Okay. This is Peter Turley and Leticia. I'll be interviewing her about the Bracero program. It's September 5th, 2010, 2 p.m. Okay, I'm going to start off with a family background, your childhood, education, and early employment. When and where were you born?
I was born in 1963, now you know my age, in Ventura County, in Ventura, and I reside in Oxnard.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in, Oxnard.
And tell me about your family and hometown.
Okay, I come from a family of 12. The first, I'm going to say five, and my parents immigrated from Mexico. My mother was born actually in Cucamonga, California. Her family migrated in the late 1800s, but they went back and moved back to Mexico, her mother, when she was a little girl. So they lived there most of their lives, or her life. And then that's where she met my dad, and they had five children, and then they came over to Oxnard, to live in Oxnard, and my parents worked the fields, and then the rest of the children were born in California. What else did you want to know? Family, and you said.
Wow, that's 12 kids. Wow, that's amazing. And what are your name? What are the names of your parents?
My father is José Victorio Delgado. He was born in 1918 in Zacatecas, Mexico. Still lives. He's 92. And my mother, who is deceased, was born in Cucamonga, California. Her family, great grandmother, first came to the States before she was born. Her mother attended school in California, and then they went back to Mexico when they had a few children, or her mother. Let's see, where else do you want me to go with this?
And what did they do for what did your parents do for a living?
Okay, they were field workers. My father worked in the fields when he was a young man. He was. They lived in a farm, so therefore that's what he did there. And he was also a musician. He played several instruments when he was a young man, and also, I guess, made some money out of that. When they came back, or they came to the United States, my mother worked in the fields for some time, and then in a packing house as she was older. My father retired from a place called CalTurf, which is a sod farm. After working there for several years, and he retired when he was 63.
Oh, so your father was a farmer all of his life.
Yes, he was a farmer all of his life, and during some time when we were in Oxnard, I remember being about maybe three or four, we migrated. We're a migrant family into Salinas to work the crops, and since I had so many brothers and sisters, the oldest worked, and then they saved enough money to buy a house in Rose Park, the area here in Oxnard, which I guess was known around the Colonia. And this is an area that they were brought to by the real estate agent because I guess there's a certain place that all Mexicans went to. And then we started to see the white flight in the neighborhood, and it became a Mexican neighborhood. So I was raised there. I was born in Colonia in Cooper Road on Hay Street. But then we migrated, made some money, and then we came back and they were able to buy a house in Rose Park.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And that's where I lived all the rest of my life.
Wow. Good. Your father, where does he live?
My father, after my mother died, decided to go back to Mexico. Uh-huh. But then he was born in Zacatecas, but he didn't want to go that far. So he stayed. He had bought a home before in Tijuana, so he lives there now. And he says he'll come back when he gets too old. So now he's in great health, that's why, he said. And then he wants us to put him in a home and go visit every day.
Now, does your father, is he legalized U.S. citizen?
Yes, he's a resident. My mother helped him become legal since she was an American citizen.
Wow.
And so, yes, he became a legal resident. Never became a citizen.
Right.
Because he always had his ties to his homeland. The usual Chicano studies, you know, I think there's a book written about that. You always want to go back. My mother said, no way. I suffer there. I'm an American citizen. I'm staying here. So he went back because there was no one to tell him anything. And he's there now. So,
wow.
And we visit sometimes, you know, like TJ is. So that's where he's at.
As long as he's happy there, that's what counts.
Yeah, yeah. In 92, you do what you want.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe contact him for an interview in the future?
Yes, when he's around. He usually comes in the holidays, or we have graduations in June. So I'll let you know. I have the last grandchild graduating this year, or, well, 2011. He'll be here. He'll be here. He always makes it. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Awesome. And so where do your brothers and sisters live now?
They all live in Oxnard. I just had the oldest brother that lived in Salinas for a while. I guess he stayed there when we were farm workers and immigrated there. But he moved back here because we're so many, and my mom started having children when she was 16. They range in lots of years. I mean, a lot of difference. My brother could be my father. He's about 65, my brother.
Oh, wow.
And so he's retired. He lives here. Hmm. All of them do.
Wow.
Youngest sister, she lives here. All of us do. I have to look at count my fingers to remember their names. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really neat. You said that the housing back then was a bit segregated. Tell me about your schooling.
I went to the local elementary school named Rose Park, and it was a neighborhood school. But during the 1970s, there's a court case, Serranos versus the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started busing us over to Marina West, which is a white side of town.
Mm.
And that lasted for a while because they only went to, I believe, third grade. So I came back to Rose Avenue School and finished fifth and sixth. And they started busing white kids to our part of town.
Mm.
And so Rose Avenue became, because so it could be fun, it became a gate school, which is a gifted school.
Mm-hmm.
By then I wasn't there, but I know because I'm in education and I've always heard of that going on.
Mm. So was that in a way, so they were trying to break segregation in a way, the school system?
Yes, that's what that court case was. Serrano sued the district because... the children only went to all brown school, and of course we know from history that the browns or schools of color received less funding, I can go on. I remember having a teacher that didn't even want to be there.
Wow.
As a child, hearing someone tell you, well, I'm going to just... the sentiment of her not wanting to be around us brown kids. I remember that. That was a bit hurtful when you're a kid you see a teacher that doesn't want to be there, doesn't want to teach us. And so because that school was segregated, they started to take us somewhere else, Marina West. And I remember it was a nice school. But that lasted for a short time.
Hmm. How did that feel going over to the white school?
Oh, it didn't feel good at all because that was my neighborhood school. I felt like I didn't belong, and being a poor kid especially, and you see kids different. I mean, you see kids that you don't belong because not only are you not dressed like them, you get the free lunch, or you know, you bring your burritos and they bring the good stuff. It's just something, you know, that you're poor. Let me just say. So. It didn't feel good. It didn't feel good. I didn't like it. I didn't like moving over there, but I did. And so I felt better once they took me back to my neighborhood school.
And when that happened, when they started busing the white kids over to your neighborhood school, how did that feel? Did you accept them, or did you?
I think that's what allowed me to be more accepting, and that's the thing about Oxnard, very diversified. Mm-hmm. It was, but I was the minority. Even though there were several white kids in a classroom. And I come from a time where it was the 1970s when I was a kid in school, mm-hmm. and you knew what was going on, not very in terms of time from the civil rights movements, you knew that you still weren't as accepted. I didn't talk Spanish because I didn't want to feel like I was an outsider. Mm. As a matter of fact, I was ashamed of being who I was. Wow. And it was difficult growing up, knowing that you're different and during those times.
You said ashamed that you were growing up in class. Much kind of studied classes this semester, I learned that how, you know, sons and daughters of Becerros were ashamed of their... Spanish ancestry or Mexican identity.
Yes, we were, because people made fun of us. And I guess I should be thankful that I wasn't going to school even earlier when my oldest siblings were. The schools didn't know how to handle bilingualism, therefore they were placed in special ed classes automatically without even being tested. Now, because I'm in the school system, I know what happens in the process to determine whether someone is... challenged educationally, so they didn't know how to handle it. They placed them there. They were made fun of. They couldn't speak the language, and so then, in a sense, they were isolated. Being a younger sibling of those, and then of course there was a time when you couldn't speak Spanish. You could not. They weren't hit. I didn't hear of that happening, but I know that after knowing history. That it did happen. I read the book Victoria Señor, Burro Genius. If that's something I would recommend. He talks about his experiences. But my experiences were more social and something that I felt in the environment, not being accepted. And not knowing knowing that I shouldn't speak English because I would be looked down at. And so I went through that throughout my, especially junior high. In high school, you become more accepting. You become more reassured of yourself, you're not as, I guess nothing worries you as much as you're a teenager trying to be accepted. I didn't care anymore.
Would you say that the laws and policies that the government passed, do you think that was a cause of society of not accepting you and your people, or do you think it was the other way around, that society reflects what the government does?
I don't think laws will ever protect biases that exist within society. The only thing that laws do is that it cannot be, you can't do it so out there. You have to try to be politically correct, but we know mm-hmm. humanity, that you will always experience that as a person of color. Laws, whatever laws may be.
And did you have a paying job while in school?
When I was in high school, I lived in Oxnard, and we are in a farming community. So during the summertime, it was real common for us all kids to go to the strawberry fields and work during the summer to make money for our school clothes. So I can't say I worked really hard, because I only did that two summers. I was 14. Did that two summers, helped my brothers and sisters, and I remember my father went to. I don't think my father worked in the fields at that time. He was in the sod farm, but he went during like a Saturday to just hang out with my brothers and sisters. But they did work hard. They did it for a lot of years. But when I was 16, I started work. I got my first. I used to babysit after that. But when I was 16, I did have a job. I was working at Carl's Jr. And I worked there a couple of years, and then, I have a big history of my employment. I don't know if I'm here now, but I mean, during school, I did work and went to school.
When you were working in the strawberry fields, how did they pay you?
You know what's so funny? I even saved my punching card. There was a punching card, and it was by box. And I think it was, I don't even remember, $2 in some sense, a box. Because they had something called por contrato. Por contrato was per hour. And then, of course, per box. So you filled your box. And it made it okay because I knew it was in my living. I didn't have to work. And like the older people that were there, the fathers and mothers that had to support mm-hmm. their family. So for me, I saw it as a fun thing. I enjoyed being there. Believe it or not, it was fun working in the strawberry. Especially know that I can go make my own money because we're a family where there's a lot of siblings. You don't ask for a lot, and you get shoes once a year. Wow. Now that I make my own money, I can spend my own money. So, yeah, I didn't have any stigma attached to the fact being out there. I wasn't embarrassed at all.
Looking back on that, how would you feel now to work in the strawberry fields as a kid? Like, reflecting as you were in the childhood, now that the stuff that you know now, what would your opinion be working in the fields as a kid?
If I was a kid at this time, mm-hmm. you mean?
Yeah, or reflecting on, now that you know the history of the U.S. and mm-hmm. the lack of, support, there's a child labor laws on the books, but mm-hmm. There's no oversight for children working in the fields. Mm-hmm. How would you feel if you were a child now working in the fields, or reflecting on what you know now?
I always was conscious that that question would apply if I wasn't conscious of what was going on then. I knew, and even the foreman knew that I wasn't pushed, bullied, or anything in regards to. I knew I didn't have to be there, especially mm-hmm. because I got a permit to work. And I've seen the programs where children do work the fields. The first generation and probably undocumented, but I knew I wasn't documented. I knew I was going somewhere. I didn't see it as a sense that somebody was abusing me, that, oh my God, I'm only earning $3 or $2. I was there as a matter of fact, it taught me resilience. Wow. It taught me to see what the worth of money was and knowing, that wasn't the point that I said, this isn't what I want to do. I knew when I was living in a household that I was in the United States and I had never been to Mexico. Perhaps it would have been different if I was an undocumented worker that came in as a child, like several do now. But my story is a bit different. I was a Chicana. There was the feeling I had. I lived during even though I was young, even in the 1960s, I remember during Vietnam, I remember being pushed on a swing by the aides, and they talked about Vietnam and Chicanos, and I for some reason that was ingrained in me early on that no one was going to get in my way or that no one's going to abuse me. It's just different mentality because I wasn't one of, perhaps if you ask my oldest brother or sister that came from Mexico, and it's a different, they lived in a different environment, perhaps they could answer differently, but I can't say it would be different then because I already knew. I knew where I was going. I knew where I came from, and I knew where I was.
That's a good thing about being raised in the Chicano generation.
Yeah,
it's a really good thing. When did you start working for wages?
There when I was working at the strawberry, I was working for wages. I used to punch a card, and I got my first paycheck. And then, of course, during high school that I worked at Carl's Jr., I was earning more wages. and maybe then is when I said, no way would I ever, I never complimented staying in that type of a job without an education. I never complimented at all, but I would see, oh, my God, I could imagine people have to do this for a living, I used to think to myself. But I loved work. I love working. I'm a worker. And it's never come to me that, oh, my God, I'm working too hard. Wow. And I did all of it. And maybe because I reflect on my parents, they worked hard. Right. No one ever told me, I'm here so you can go to school. I knew it. You know it. When you don't have anything, you know it. No one has to tell you.
Wow. Wow. Some people will complain about working, and they're working me as a slave. I'm not getting wage. Slave wages. And
I tell you, I couldn't wait to go to school, to work. I couldn't wait. And I was so happy when I finally got the real job out there where I got a bigger paycheck working a cashier. And I know I was earning more experience, especially working with the public. I was a really retrieved, shy girl. Mm-hmm. And that even helped me to develop more as an individual. So no complaint from me. I remember even whistling as I cleaned the tables at Carl's Jr. Wow. I love working. I still do. No complaint here. Different mentality. Except when I scrub toilets.
No. When I worked at Target, I was going to complain and explain. I'm not working for the man anymore.
No, I know. And you know what? That's funny you say that, because it's a difference from generations.
Right.
My kids, my son says, it's funny, he says, he's in Berkeley, and he says, I'm not coming home on him anymore, Mom. I said, why is that, son? You make me work too much. I said, and what is that, son? I make him take the trash out sometimes. He doesn't work. These kids don't work. And I know you're younger, but these are even the younger kids, the Xers, Generation X. They don't like to work. It's because we gave them too much. That's what I think. I didn't have anything. I knew I had to work for what I had.
Right. Wow. It's interesting. Giving too much. Wow.
Yeah. Well, not gave too much, but everything came easy. I never spoiled my kids with a lot of things. Wow. Just things were easier for us. Nothing was taken for granted. Nothing.
That makes sense.
Wow. My feet are such a good runner. Tenderfoot. I said, take my shoes off when I got home from school, because those pair of shoes had to last all year. And so I used to go out and play and run in the streets. I said, I think I have to have a glass inside. If you know the Tamahara Indians with the feet, they have some hard feet.
Wow.
Not a lot of injuries.
Huh. Wow, you're a proud Chicana.
I am.
Down with the movement. I'm going to ask about marriage and children. Are you married?
Yes, I am married. I married when I was about, let's see. Well, you're ready to my age, 1963. I was 23 years old when I got married, and my husband was going to school. He was in Northridge finishing up. And I had been in Ventura College taking classes here and there, but I was working full-time at the time. And I think maybe, you go through this thing when you're young and you're not sure. You kind of don't have your act together, I just say. But I always worked. I worked full-time. And so I didn't get my, so I got my AA early, but I didn't get my bachelor's till later. My kids were probably about 4 when they started school. I went back and finished up at Northridge Extension. I didn't have to travel anywhere. I'm in education. I always knew that's what I wanted to do. Something about working hard, and I'm the type of person who works last minute and probably likes to push myself. When you have to work have to go to school and you have 3 kids, it just makes it even nice to be out there in school. From the kids or some reason. So I've always worked all my life, but during the time that my kids were born, I did take some years off to be a full-time mother. And my husband, of course, was the one with paycheck. So I took care of my kids, and they always saw me as a model, role model of how important school was. So whenever they were in school, I took classes. They came out, I was there to pick them up. So.
What's your husband's name?
My husband's name is Chris. He's not a Chicano or a Mexican. He's a mixed person, and his mom is white from Germany, ancestry. His father is Native American, and some other mixes, also English. And he just has a lot of mixes. So when I raised my kids, I wanted to make sure that they spoke Spanish and that they knew their Chicano roots. Mm-hmm. And so my boy especially is very proud. For some reason, boys are more like their moms. My boy, my girls are still teenagers going through this weird thing. They haven't found their identity, I think. but now that my daughter is my daughters are in college now. They just graduated. They're 18.
Oh.
Yeah, they just turned 18. My daughter goes to Humboldt, and you know, when you're in university setting, you know, you reach out for your roots, and I see her doing that, asking
That's
me for
great.
Care packets with Mexican stuff. I don't send it. I don't spoil. I don't say anything.
Make your own care packets.
Yeah. So, but I see them, and it's because I'm a very proud person, and my son, you know, he's taking the Chicano study classes. Aww. And you know how people connect more, and they're he's always been accepting. He's been comfortable. He's lived in a different era, not a time when I was growing up. It's okay to be Latino. As a matter of fact, people want to be Latino these times. So they lived in a time where it's okay. I live in a time when it wasn't okay.
Wow. Yeah, because right now they live in a time where the Chicano name has been not really used these days.
Yeah.
It's like it's been lost. It's like, because it was like seen in I saw Blood and Blood Out for the first time a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It's about Chicano gangs in the 70s and 80s.
Oh.
And, and because before the Chicano movement was about unity, but somehow, with the Black nationalism movement, that instead of going after uniting against the oppression of the white men did to the Chicanos and Black nationalists, they gradually over time they went against each other. Like the Chicanos went against each other, each other. Chicanos, and
they
went against each other, and then the blacks went against the blacks, and mm-hmm. the Chicanos went against the Chicanos, and they started to form gangs that started to like, this is our territory, mm-hmm. all at the same time when the government was oppressing them, but they didn't realize it because they were battling for territory against each other, mm-hmm. and so people associated Chicano with gangs.
You know what's so funny? I teach geography and culture, and part of that, because we're in Latin America, I wanted to define some terms, and I put the terms, Hispanic, Chicano, Latino, and I asked the students, and I got to the term Chicano. I mm-hmm. said, how about the term Chicano? Does anybody raise your hand? Have you heard the word? Okay, you heard the word. Okay, what does it mean, cholo? Mm-hmm. And goes with what you just said. And I clarified it. I talked about the civil rights movement at a certain time that we were out there. And so it's still a connection to, I told them it's a gangster, and of course they start laughing. I said, you're connecting it to being a gangster, but that's not true.
Right.
And so it still exists.
Right, it does.
And we do offer one Chicano studies in school, but they don't all take it because you're taking other classes. So a lot of Chicano kids still associate that word. And it was funny for them to say, I'm a Chicana. And I thought, whoa. And I said, that's how I came with the kids like that. I said, ooh, Miss Carl. Lean like a child. The kids just like, So it's still associated with that.
Wow.
And because I teach culture, I clarify it with the kids. And in our school we have, and that's the same school I attended Channelized High School.
Wow.
A lot of diversity. At that time, we had a lot of African Americans, which we don't now because our population's declined. I don't know if you...
Yeah, I noticed that, yeah.
Yeah.
All the black students at Channel Islands, Cal State Channel Islands, they're all from, L.A., the L.A. region.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a survey done or a study done as to why this was going on in Ventura County. They interviewed some black people, and they had said, and it's funny because you mentioned how we pit against each other,
right.
and it's still going on, that they said that Mexicans got more opportunity than they did.
Huh.
That was a sentiment, and that's the reason they left. A lot of them went to Bakersfield, the other areas, and that they did a study. There was a 1 week long, and it's funny, you could probably look it up in the Star about why this exodus occurred, and they still see us as someone that interferes with their ability to move up, and we're still in the high schools. it's still, especially Oxnard, because I taught in Oxnard for a year, and since the beginning of 1990s, it was Chicanos against blacks, and it's still going on. There was always rumbles that in Oxnard, especially Oxnard, and you know why Oxnard is because they have more of a black population in that school. You don't see that in other schools, Channel Islands, more the south side with Chiques, you know, kids doing that kind of stuff, but it's still going on. And as you said, you know, the focus is not placed on what the government, the laws, the institutions, more, all of a sudden you start pitting against each other, and it's the same sentiment. I had a Chicano class, I don't remember what it was, in Northridge one time, and the woman that was giving the class, the instructor, I don't remember, she was a professor, but she said, I went to a conference, and one black woman told me, we have worked so hard, and you are interfering with our ability to move up. Straight out, told her out as a professional, and that sentiment's still the same. Still the same. Has not changed. See, I'm out there to see it in the high schools, and I would say to you that even as a professional myself, same thing exists. The way people think about us, that we must have gotten a free ride to school, or we are not as savvy, or why are we on the top? Because I'm attempting to become be in administration. I have a master's also in administration, mm-hmm. school administration, and it's difficult as a Chican, a Latina, and a woman moving up. And it's still out there. You know, all those, that's why I'm saying laws be laws, no laws, yes laws. Where people in society still, wow. those biases still exist. Even, and I often tell my students, when you're educated, it's more difficult to make you a doofus, but even so, you still have powers of pressing down on you. And right, I still, right. I feel that. I feel I and other professionals in my area, we often talked about that. They didn't see us equal. People in our own profession, you would say we're colleagues. No, it's still separate, even in the professional world.
There's a hierarchical structure.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Then, and I hate to say, there's a white male still in control.
Pretty much.
Right. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Wow. That's.
We went somewhere else with this conversation.
Yeah, that's no. It's important. It's really important because that's going to this. Yeah. That's going to this Smithsonian, uh-huh. and people need to hear this. Yeah. And it's all part of like a child growing up. You know, a child episode of growing up. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's. Yeah.
The battle has not.
That's sad.
Ended,
yeah.
And I don't think it ever will.
Yeah. So maybe it will still be keep going forever and ever.
Yeah, it will. Different.
It's unfortunate, but you know. Shouldn't it be the way, but it is.
It is.
And where did you get? Where did you first live when you got married?
I live in Ventura. I lived in Ventura because it happened that my husband got a job. He was finishing up. He's a business major. He was finishing up in systems administration. Also, I think that's his. His minor. So we lived in Ventura because he got a job apartments, being apartment manager.
Oh, great.
And so he's from Ventura. His family's from Ventura. They're Venturans for many generations. They're
awesome.
We lived there for over 10 years, and my kids went to most all white schools in Ventura. You know, it's funny because we were in the city, same county. But as a matter of fact, you know, so cute is I enjoyed the fact that my son was a Latino going to a school because the kids they saw him as different. They loved him. Kids are so accepting, you know, little kids in kinder. And there was one black little girl. And it's so funny because I had talked to the teacher, Mrs. Fleckinger, mm-hmm. and we were talking about this little girl that often cried. Mm. And psychologically, you can analyze. You know, being one black person there, mm-hmm. and she said, you know, she cries so much, and it's easy for us to move kids to other classes, but I don't want to because she's black. I want the kids to have experiences of a black child. You know, the teacher realized that, and when you think about it, and I'm sure sociologists have made that study, you feel outcasted. you feel alone. I remember going to, because I used to help out in the class. I was going to be a teacher, so I used to do my hours and go help in the class. And so my son, they had no problem accepting Latino kids. There were several others. Not as much. We're still the minority. All white teachers, something that I observed, of course. And it's funny because one time one of the teachers, it must have been second grade, I was really involved in the school because that was my job, my kids. So I used to go observe and check out what's going on, keep up with the teachers, make sure they were doing their jobs. One time a teacher, I think it must have been preschool, they did a collage of the family. And my son came home with pictures of all white people. And the next day I went to school and I said, "I this is really nice, but I realized you don't have any brown pictures. My son is not white-skinned. This does not reflect who he is." So I was out there. And so the teacher was like, what? And I even approached her. I said, "No, you pay attention to things like that. When you're an educator, you pay attention. You make sure to involve or that everybody's represented, all colors." Especially, I try to do that because I have a lot of Asian kids in my class. Well, Pacific Islanders from the Philippines and Channel Islands. I have to make sure that I include them, and I include people that look like them, music like them, everything like that. So I was always out looking for that stuff.
Wow.
Everyone didn't like me. I was in their faces, let me tell you.
That's funny.
So my kids went to Ventura schools, and then I made the choice, a conscious choice. I've gone back to school. My earning potential was higher, both my husband and I. And we can buy any house we want anywhere. But I said, you know what? I want to go back to Oxnard so that my kids could grow up around Chicano kids.
Great.
I did.
That's great.
Because our family's also white. I mean, right. I can't deny that. My mother-in-law's white. So I said, I want my kids to be exposed to the culture. And I said, I'm moving back to Oxnard. And I did. Because you hear people, you don't want to move to Oxnard. A lot of Mexicans. You know, and you hear all the time still. And us people, we joke around about it.
How did Chris view moving back to Oxnard with you? Did he?
I was a boss. I'm the boss. You're not the boss. You better learn that. He knows what's so funny. He's really accepting. That's probably why I've been with him for this long. He's accepting of my differences. I'm very vocal. And he knows how important my culture is. And for him, because he is of a mixed race, it was difficult for him growing up, because you're either not accepted as a white because you don't look white, you're not accepted by the Mexican because guess what? On the inside, you're white.
Right.
And he says that he it's funny because he joined the Latino Business Association to fit in somewhere because they looked like him. He looks brown on the outside, but they weren't accepting on him. They always saw him as different. But later on, they accepted him because he was a DJ and he would play at their parties. But, they took him in, but he still never felt belong. So he told me that when he married me, he married a culture, too. And it felt nice belonging somewhere.
Wow. So it's all about the authenticity, like the Mexicans or the Latinos. Another person, are you authentic enough? You got to be one of us.
Yeah.
You got to dress like us. You got to talk like us. You can't talk like the American. You can't be Americanized or else you're not authentic or.
Yeah. And it's funny because I faced similar, not the same as him because he's obviously white and mixed and not necessarily Latino either. See, he doesn't have the Mexican culture because his father was born during, I think his mother might have been Latina. He was born in a time when it's not okay to be Latino, and they got hit and they were ousted, and he suffered all that stuff. So therefore, he made sure he married a white woman, and his kid, there is no trace of any cultural identity in regards to being someone of Mexican descent in his family. He will tell you he is not a Mexican. My father-in-law, he graduated from Ventura High. He traces his lineage to being Native American, even though he's not that much, because it's not okay. It's not okay during his time. And so my husband grew up with more associating, and I said, that's why I'm saying mothers, kids, boys are more like their mothers, so he's more white. And his father was white. He's white. So I don't remember where I am going. Why I'm going this way in my conversation, but
yeah, that's cool. It's interesting.
So for me, it was you know, being a Chicana, my husband was okay in accepting of that. So it was okay. We moved to Austin. Wow. I think that's where I went. That conversation went somewhere else.
No, that's great.
So you got to gear me because I start going.
Oh no, it's great. That's awesome. It's like information that we didn't learn in class. I can add it to my presentation tomorrow. It's really great. Wow. He's like me, you know. I'm white, and I'm trying to find my own identity. Like, can I identify with this Chicana culture or with these Chicana people? Maybe they just see me as a white person, but I see myself as Chicano. So it all depends on how society sees me as, not the other way around. No,
yeah, like myself. So. Unfortunately, that's funny. It's how people perceive you.
Yeah.
Like, we always have a joke amongst us Latinos. You can be educated, you can do whatever you want, but you'll always be brown.
Yeah,
you know,
and
people will perceive
white.
You. And
I can major, I can be a doctor in Chicano studies, but I'll always be white.
Yes, me too. I will always be a brown person no matter what. And this is the way people perceive you.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
It's unfortunate, but...
Yeah. And, you know, that in regards to white, I always, because I teach culture, and the white kids are a minority in our classes. Poor guys. Now, and I know how they feel. I told them I know how I feel.
Right.
When I was one of five Latinos. So I try to emphasize that they do have the roots. That guess what? Your ancestors, even though it's like five generations ago... what are they? Reach out for them. Are they from Ireland, from France, what, Germany?
Right.
You were detached from those because we had this concept of the melting pot, and therefore you blended in easily. We never did, so we retained what was important to us as so we can have an identity. And you were, in essence, made to just let go of everything that your family did have. You know, I have a friend that's, well, I haven't seen her in years, but she was white, blue eyes, blonde hair, and she held on to being Italian because it feels good to have some culture. And so I try to emphasize to the kids that are white, you have a culture. You have a culture, and find what it is. And, of course, we know American. It just doesn't sound for them. Like, especially when I'm always, about Native Americans, and maybe they feel that I'm bashing what the colonizers did. Remember, that's history. A good Indian is a dead Indian is what they used to say. So, you know, I even see a student's kind of like, oh, man, I'm the only white brother's two white kids. Like, you know? So I empathize because I know what it feels to be minority. They're a minority in my class, and that doesn't feel too good either. So I try to be equal in regards to that. It's a little bit different when you're a person that went through, you walked in my moccasins, and so you empathize enough with other people and their desire as humans to reach for a culture that's so important, their identity. So,
yeah,
so I know it's hard to be white nowadays, especially in Oxnard. 65%.
Hey, I'm part of you. I'm on your side. I'm on their side.
Yeah. And you know what? And what I learned is people like you, we love people like you because there's a bridge, a connection to say, hey, you know what? They're not that bad people.
Right.
And all these stereotypes that you other people have, you know. I used to have a friend. I remember his name, Neil. Neil was from Massachusetts, and I used to work at a bank during my... I mean, I've always worked, so I have a big history of employment. I worked in every area. And so I used to work at a bank, and Neil had never met a Mexican. And I opened his eyes, and I changed the way he thought about people because they have these stereotypes, Mexicans being dumb and lazy. Mm-hmm. I said, where in the world? I am such a hard worker. You know, I'm a marathon runner, too. Where would they get there? I can, you know, so he had that conception. Where he's from, I think they had a lot of Puerto Ricans, I think. And so he even told me, he goes, God, before I met you, I think he kind of liked me too. I was 25, I was already married, but I know that Neil kind of like, he liked me as a person, knowing that, wow, we can talk here intellectually. At that time I was 25, I was taking classes here and there. I was always working full time, but you know, I wasn't You're still educated even if you don't have a college degree, because you're you're in essence you're alert as to what's going on in the environment. You read the paper. You read. You're basically not, I wasn't in a shell. I never have been. I'm that type of a person. So Neil was I think turned on to the fact that I was a person that he had these stereotypes about. And hey, you guys aren't that bad. So people, white people serve as a bridge. So therefore, he can go back and say, hey, you know, Mexicans are cool. It's okay. And, you know, another experience I have, that Italian friend I told you about, her relatives had never been to California. She picked him up in the airport. She said, hey, you want to go with me? I must have been about 20 years old. And I said, sure, I'll go with you. And so it's funny. The first thing they noticed was, oh, my God, look at the palm trees. They were from Ohio. Look at the palm trees. And he goes, and then one of the guy cousins says, where's the spitz? You know what spitz are?
Spitz, no.
That's what they used to call Mexicans in the 1950s or 40s. And it's funny that they use that term. To me, I learned it somewhere around. I don't remember where. And I said, I thought, you looked at the palm tree, now you're looking for the Mexicans. And they he used a derogatory name, like, where's the wetbacks, you know? And I just sat there like, oh, my God. You know? So every person will have, depending on where you're from, will have different stereotypes, right? So I think in California, a little bit more progressive, because we're so diverse.
Wow. And going back to your children, what are their names?
I have a son. My firstborn is Esteban, and I named him. I made sure that I gave him Latino names. Yeah, and so I named him Esteban because at the time I used to work at the county social service agency. I was working at a case. I was caseworker, and the last case I worked for, the guy's name was Esteban. So I said, you know, this is a pretty name. Esteban was nice, and then I named the middle name Manuel after my brother, and of course they have their father's last name. And the interesting, their father's last name is not Latino. It's Native American, because we know the history.
Right.
The Spanish came in, and then they gave the names to the indigenous people. They never dropped the A. So my name, Carabajal. The new Carbajal, they changed it to V and dropped an A.
Oh, really?
So it's Carabajal. It's so funny because people always try to correct my name and drop an A. You spelled it wrong. No, I didn't. C-A-R-A, you know. And so they have his last name. And then I have twin daughters. My twin daughter's Sara. And she pronounces it that way too, Sara. And I told my husband, all right, you get a middle name that you choose. So he named after his grandmother, and his sister are born Candida, which is the middle name, and Dan's last name. And his sister, her sister's name Alexandria. And it's funny because I try to name her after my grandmother. Later on, I asked my dad, what was your mom's name? He says, Alejandria, or Alejandra. I said, Dad, you told me her name was Alejandria. And then I named my daughter Alejandra, Alejandria. What? Well, anyways, I supposedly named her after my grandmother. No middle name. Those are my kids. And one of my daughters is going to mature college because she chose to stay around with a boyfriend. She was ready to go to San Francisco State. So
love got in the way.
Yeah, and so she's going to be moving to Humboldt with her sister. And my son, this is his second year. He's 20 years old.
Wow.
Second year in Berkeley. And he's pursuing medicine, but he's a lazy kid, so he doesn't like to work. But he's a gifted kid. He's sharp, he's so smart. Good. So those are my kids.
Is it sad to see your kids grow up and leave the
I sure did. It was difficult. It still is now, especially because, my daughters have gone through that difficult time in their lives. Even though you have an intact family, the peer pressure, the rebellious, the new generation where we attempted to raise our kids better than our parents did, giving them more freedoms, you know, even as regards to freedoms of all types, freedom to be able to say what you feel without your parents shutting you down, especially when you're a Latino family. You don't say stuff unless you're asked. You don't look at your parents' eyes. Like I said, don't look at me, right? So I attempted to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And of course, what we created were different kids that are risk takers that will talk back to you. I even used to have my kids let them draw their walls. That's how liberal I am. Because I wanted to create an environment that allowed my kids to express themselves, yes, and not, but there's also a consequence to,
yes,
that. They have constantly challenged me,
but that's,
especially my girls.
I think that's good. I think that's okay for teach your kids to be like, you know, challenge the status quo. Always think, ask questions. Okay, is this person, do I think she or he's right, or,
yes,
or am I right, or what's wrong in this, like,
yes,
with this, like, you know, how can I fix, or what?
Yes, and you know what, really they're good. They're the type that seeks social justice.
That's really good.
One time, but in a sense, let's back up, because one time my daughter said, she was at work, she said another job she had, I don't like the fact that they give other people the discount and let them buy a lot of items, because usually they she worked at a certain, I won't say where, but a certain store where office place,
mm-hmm,
and like for instance, if you wanted to buy a sharpener, you could limit three. But she goes, I didn't like the fact that when Mexicans came up, they didn't let them buy more than three, and they would just ring them all up together and let them buy more. So I did it. I said, it's not your say so. Even if someone else doesn't do it that way, if policy, that's not your company. Now, if you were running your own business, you'd do it your way. So in a sense, it's good and not good.
Right.
Right. You have to be careful as to whose rules are you breaking. So I think I didn't create them because they came in with their own DNA. I've never claimed that they belong to me, but I created an environment that allowed them to do that. Hopefully they will be those next generations that will challenge those laws, those institutions that bring people down. You know, so.
Mom, hopefully, yeah. Sound like really great kids.
Mm. Right now it's a challenge, though, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I feel like, I'm 18, I don't have to come home if I don't want to. So I told my daughter, you're leaving then at the end of December. I said, okay, then you find a place. You don't want to follow the rules. So that's a challenge,
yeah.
See, I come from a generation, you don't speak when you're not spoken, you don't go out. I couldn't date.
Yeah.
I mean, how are you supposed to meet people you can't date? I encourage my daughters to date. I've always have. I still hold on to my traditions. You know, mm-hmm, there's certain things I expect, and that's what's been a challenge, being married to someone that has different views. I would say the American view. For me, it's like you have to be home at a certain time. Who are you with? The guy can't go in the house, all this stuff. You can't go over and spend the night. My husband is, what are you talking about? What's the big deal? So that has always been a challenge. That's a difficult when you marry someone that's another culture, another beliefs, when you raise the children.
What's also difficult is when you have kids who are raised in like the Americanized setting, and they have the parent who has been raised in the traditional Mexican setting, and then you have to explain to the kids, it's not because I don't like you, it's because it's the way I was raised.
Yeah, exactly. My ideals, and they work. They work because that's why I chose the right path. But in the sense, I'm not a risk taker. I'm the way I am because it's my genetics.
Wow.
But, you know, they raised me in an environment I was afraid. I got hit. You couldn't do this. No, you know, I was restricted. I couldn't be who I wanted, who I was. I think whose potential I had. I had more potential, but I don't think that I was raised in that environment. So that's the negative aspect of it. I mean, I was out there whoring around and stuff, which is good, or drinking and doing drugs and stuff, but still.
That's good.
And it's funny because there was a special one time in one of these news programs where they analyzed the different generations and what the impact was on society of those generations. Our generation, I'm part of the baby boom, We work hard. We're company people. We will work to the last moment. Where the kids at Xers, they want to be rewarded. They have to be told they have to be worked and constantly be praised for what they do. Because if you recall when, you know, we started this thing about, oh, you're trying to praise them, overpraise them, which worked really against you. You have different kinds of kids that don't want to be working. Something else motivates them.
Right. But I don't want to be working. But what I don't like working. I don't like authority.
Yes, there you go.
What motivates me is like thinking critically and asking these questions and probably working for like a civil rights or something or the community and finding ways to work for the community. Mm-hmm. I like working for the community, not for, you know, a business that's already there.
Yes.
I know.
You're like a typical young person. You guys are the ones that are going to make the changes in.
Yeah, we are.
There we go. Well, we just need someone to work for us because the population is aging.
It is, yeah.
They're going to be marching out there, but we need you to put in some money in the system.
Right.
That's what I tell my students, and they go, yeah, they're surprised
because
we.
Much, but
yeah, we talk about population and population shifts and inequalities and population growth, and I said we're aging. You guys need to go out there and earn more, get educated, put into the system. There's not being no Social Security when I'm out there anymore. You know, but and there's less of them, so yeah, that's an impact.
Yeah.
So get off of the marching, put your sign down. And go.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but we need that though. We need that.
Yeah.
Has to be a balance. That's what my daughter's cracking me up. They want to go to India and do this and that. I said, how prepared are you? You have to have an earning potential first.
Exactly.
You want to save the world, you know?
Got to change yourself before you change the world.
Yes, it's so funny.
You got to, like, you know, that's what I found out.
Yeah. Money got to go from somewhere.
Yeah. So I'm going to move on to the Basotho program. Would you like to take a break before we...
No, I'm fine.
Okay, cool.
I have some water I'll just drink as I go. I don't have to drink in here, but...
Well, whatever. Special circumstances.
Don't seize me. Okay.
Okay. Did your father ever tell you about the Basotho program?
I had heard some mention, not him directly having a conversation. And the reason that I knew about him being a Bracero is because I was reading the paper and I found out about... the Braceros having a meeting, and they announced it about, I'm going to say about 5 years ago. And just not too long ago, I had my dad over during the summertime, and we're talking, and he mentioned the Bracero, having worked, being all over the states. And I said, what, Dad? What states? Well, yeah, I was in Oregon. I was in Wisconsin. I remember what it was when I was in Mexico. Well, I wrote everything down. I'll let you know in a second. And then I said, oh, tell me more about it. And so I was interested, and that's when I went online and I looked up about the program. I saw the lawsuit, and it was a report by Yale University, I think it was, that described the process and Ventura and how he started the lawsuit because his mother that was living in Mexico as son wanted to find out about me qualifying for Social Security benefits and what he saw. Your father worked in the United States. What he saw was the contract that his father had as a bracero, or was it his grandfather? I remember what it was. Probably his father, the older man. I mean, my father was a bracero, so his must have been a bracero.
Yeah, I think it was Ventura's
father.
Yeah.
And we know the story. And then that's when I asked my father information. He didn't have the contract anymore because he came to the United States. And so everything was lost in the move because first he went to TJ, and then, you know, when we came to Colonia, first place where we lived, they went to Salinas, migrated to work, and then came back. So, you know, paper
right.
for him, who
right.
he didn't even think. But his brothers were also braceros. They stayed in Mexico. They weren't as fortunate because it's a third world country.
Mm-hmm.
But they had their documents. They have... died already, and they haven't received. So the widows, they're aging people. My father, he lives a better life. That's the reason he's still healthy in 92. But his brothers, I think he comes from a family of, let me see, I think a family of six. Most of them have passed away. There's probably two that are alive, and then my dad. And so they haven't gotten any payments. So I talked to my father, and I interviewed him, and I wrote down some stuff, and he has a great memory. So he was able to tell me where he had worked. And he worked as a bracero for 5 years while he was in Mexico. And the reason they stayed in Mexico is because my mother never knew she was a citizen until one day she calls. I mean, they lived in complete poverty. They had five kids, and she knew she had to help out and do something. So she calls her. She knew she had relatives in the United States. So she calls her tía Francisca and says, "Hey, tía, can you help me out? I really need to come down. It's really hard living here. Maybe I can work for you. You can help me." Come over to the States. She goes, "What are you talking about, mija? You're an American citizen." Yeah, and so what's funny is her her mother never told her, because her mother didn't want her to leave. Her mother never told her. And so she resented her mother for all this. Yeah, never told her. And my mom resents it because she knows her life could have been better way, but she suffered tremendously. Wow. Suffered hunger.
Extreme
poverty, living in a country like Mexico. And so, she's the one that came over and worked and cleaning houses, working the fields. As a matter of fact, she was working the fields. She was pregnant with me. And she said that a man questioned her. She said, "What are you doing? Look at you, woman. You think that man cares so much for you? Look at you, pregnant." Pregnant in the fields, my mother was, in the 1960s. So my family came over in, I think, 1964 must have been. I was born here, and I was born on Thanksgiving, and my mom remembers, because my mom, after she moved to TJ and she knew she was an American citizen, she can come over legally. She came over the border and to deliver my sister, and then she didn't make it for another one. She knew I was pregnant, my poor mom. And so anyway, so I knew he had told me that he had worked as a bracero, and I wrote some things down, and so I was able to interview him.
Oh, awesome. So he just told you this just recently, about 5 years ago?
Maybe about 3 years ago.
3 years ago?
He told me about it, yeah, over lunch, and I think I had heard bracero, but I didn't really pay attention, maybe. Right. And I didn't do anything. I guess summertime, you know, he's in time relaxing. Hey, what's going on?
So why do you think he waited this long to tell you? How come he just didn't see you down?
He didn't think of it as important, and you have to realize a relationship of a father and a daughter with a big family. You don't really sit down and talk. And as you get older, you find a connection with your parents. I connected with my parents. No, my father worked, came home, was grumpy at times, and went to bed. Get up the next day super early, and you don't talk to your father. You don't have time. You talk to your mom.
Wow.
But it's not. I have a relationship now with my father that I established a long time ago. Maybe when I was in high school, maybe as a senior, and I talked to him a bit more, but not so much because I was still a teenager, doing my own thing. So when you're an adult, you stop and you talk more with your parents. That's just human nature, I think.
Do you, in your opinion, do you think, even though the Basota ended in political terms, it ended in 64, do you think it ever ended for your father?
Because he was lucky enough to land a full-time job and not seasonal at the sod farm. It did end once he stopped working in the fields, because he worked really hard in the fields, and we know underpaid, overworked. So it did end when he started that, and he worked in that company for 30 years, for a long time. So it ended once if he had been someone that just continued working in the fields, it probably never would have, because we know the history of the farm worker. So maybe that's why he saw it as something from far away. Because he said that it was difficult working in the fields, and one of the hardest things was working in the salary. He still suffers arm pain. And then, of course, my mother also worked in the fields. And being a pregnant woman, I think she worked even harder than my father. So it ended when he was lucky and landed a full-time job that sometimes when it rained, he didn't work, but you're there most of the time, and that what brought us, we were lucky. We're lucky he had the, and my mom stayed home for many years because of that. I mean, not that she can work when she's always pregnant, and things are a little bit different here. She didn't have to. She'd go back to work till later on.
Wow. And did he tell you, did he really go into that deep about his experiences in the program?
No, no, he did not. You know, something I reflect on maybe because I'm a female, and you don't tell your daughter that, guess what, they would make me take off my clothes and spread it and spray me down with DDT. But I learned about those experiences because of the men that I've talked to, because of they're in the Bracero program, that have gotten a little close to me. But he never did. When I asked him, I said, "Okay, Pops, I'm gonna interview you. This is the date." You know, I did the same thing here, and I said, "When did you start working as a Bracero?" He gave me all his information. How was life for you? "Oh, estaba bien." Okay, come on, Pops. What did you do there? What was your social life like? And I think that, I don't think he would want to tell me when he knows that he's married over here. I don't know what he did. If he went out and partied or what? Or what did he do? Went over to a whorehouse? I don't know. He wasn't going to tell you that stuff. Right? So, you know, the information that he gave me, I did write it down. This is what he told me. He said that he started working in 1952 in Paso, Texas. Some were called it, and because my dad doesn't speak English, and, you know, the accent, it's a little difficult to understand what it is, the rancho they work with, but he remembered the ranchos. Some place called Canso Springs in Rancho Guerrero. They only gave him work for 2 months there, that he worked from September to October. And then again, so he would return. He said that they would, he didn't even tell me how they processed them. He just said that they would give a contract and a mica. And I said, "Well, Dad, did you ever read the contract?" "No, de estaban tan paisas." He said, we couldn't even read. We should just take whatever. We didn't look at it. We gave us a contract because I mentioned about the 10%. "You know about the 10%, Pop?" "No, I didn't know about that. I just went to work. I was glad I was going to go to work." And so in 1953, so every year, this was a reoccurrence for 5 years after 52. In 1953, he worked in some place called Mission, Texas for 3 months from September to December. And then in 1954 in Arkansas, he picked cotton from April to June. 1955, he was in Nebraska. In 1956, he was in New Mexico for 2 months, from May to July. 1957, that's when he came to California, somewhere called Santa Rosa. He remembers the ranch, Rancho Guerrevilla. And that was for 3 months. And he gave me all the details in his where I recorded him. He even remembered a foreman and how much he told me how much they would earn, a paycheck. I just don't remember where I put that stuff. But I did record it with the details, and maybe something you get when you talk to him, right? Mm-hmm. But that's about the what he remembered. He gave me dates, places. What he picked, he told me the type of crops that he was picking at the time. But he didn't talk to me in detail about the processing of him as an individual and what we know about history, how they went through the whole thing, that he never talked to me about.
It's a repressed memory, could be?
Yeah, it could be. Because as we know how they suffered to get over there. But it seemed like once he got in, he was able to return and do it for 5 years, because you met my friend that she said her father never got to the line. They just told him, "Nope, we don't need you." So my father, I guess they knew him. He was a strong-looking man. I hope I didn't hurt Mary Spilly when I said that. I mean, it just, my father was a young man, and they took him. They took him and his brothers. And I don't know if you call it lucky. It didn't help anything, because my mom my mom had to come to the United States and work. As a woman, you have to work and support the family. So it must have not been any benefit to the family, because they were still in poverty. Quite didn't help. So
So the program really, in his case, the program didn't do what the U.S. government, Mexican government wanted it do. The Mexican government wanted them to bring.
Right. It didn't do it. Economically, it was supposed to help the families in Mexico or help. It was not only a give and take, but a give and give, and that's not what happened. That's really not what happened. Because they were still in poverty, and things didn't change until my mother migrated the whole family because she was an American citizen.
So in the so you just mentioned you didn't know how much he got paid, but...
He mentioned what he got paid. I don't know. I don't remember. Okay. He did tell me, and I wrote it down, and I have it in recording. And like I said, that's something he can let you know. It was like cents. I don't remember. 50 cents. I don't remember. I said, whoa, you know. And I wrote it somewhere else, but anyways, yeah, you'll get that information from him.
Okay. Do you know off by hand, including when you were born, he was still a farm worker. How much money did he bring home to the family?
Oh, I don't know that. I wasn't born then, and I would never pay attention to it. The thing that it required all my siblings, my brothers, to work in order to make enough money. And that's the reason we know why people in poverty have lots of family members so they can help out. So it was my oldest brother, Jesus, my oldest brother, Luis, my oldest brother, Arnulfo, my oldest brother, Constantin, four boys working, and the girls stayed and help in the house. So four boys plus my dad working, and sometimes my mom would go. So that's six people, and they were able to get money together, and well, houses weren't expensive at that time, but it required, like, I don't know how much they earned.
When he told you about his experiences and you first researched about the program, how did that make you feel?
He really didn't tell me more. there were holes in his story. It was too vague. That's how it made me feel. I wasn't satin because there was nothing to be sad at. He didn't tell me anything. So I just thought, wow, you know, that's important. You did that. I mean, now knowing more about the Raceros and their experiences, of course, I think, damn, my dad's a tough guy. He dealt with a lot. But like I said, a woman has a harder job. I think my mom dealt with more. But I know this is about Braceros. My mother did.
Yeah. Oh, good. Maybe in the future, could be something about
females workers in the field.
Yeah, right? Or females like within the Braceros program.
What was going on at home while he was, and how they suffered. She was lucky she had family over there that helped him out sometime, and but extreme poverty, where my brothers say they used to ask for beg for food in TJ when my mom came over here. They used to call it pedir taco in a restaurant. Can we have some food? Go on the trash cans, try to do anything to shine shoes, and just you see that in TJ. All the kids that was my brothers and sisters. They suffered like heck.
Did your father ever tell you where he enrolled in the Braceros program?
He enrolled?
Or where did he travel to enroll?
He said in Zacatecas. He was in Zacatecas, yeah. I don't know whether they took him from there to another processing center, but he said they're in Zacatecas. He did tell me, and I remember asking him what was the process, and I think that they bussed him somewhere. I don't remember. It was a processing center.
And did you ever talk to other Bracero families? And if so, what did you talk about?
Not Bracero families. I've talked to the Bracero men, a few of them. And one of them did mention how difficult it was in regards to how they were treated and how they made him take his clothes off and spray him with DDT. I don't know how that conversation came about, but that they did tell me about it. And you know, it's funny because there's one man that I was driving to Santa Paula, and I was helping him with copies for some documents that Ramon needed. I said, one time, and this is a little upsetting to me, I went to scan a document for him that Ramon needed in San Bernardino. So I said, I went to Mr. Nichols' house, and when I was there was a woman that was his daughter about my age, speaking great English, and I thought to myself, this man has people that can help him, and why am I doing this? I mean, I know I'm not selfish in regards to me helping people, but I thought, what is going on? So I one time asked Mr. Nico, I notice you have children, and I thought he was by himself. He was an old man, no one would help him out. He said, oh, my kids don't care. They don't care anything about braceros, especially when I talked to him about that, the premiere of the film. He said, no, they don't care. So these people, the children, they're not as connected. They don't give a hoot. To them, it's like, oh, where does my dad go? Where does this bracero thing? It's funny, I asked another man I give a ride to over there to Cal State Channel. I said, oh, they don't care. How could you not care? I mean, just different sentiments. The children of these braceros, and that's the reason there's not a lot of me out there, people. They're not doing anything for their parents. Like, come on. This is history's going to be lost. But why aren't you more motivated? And I even, for one time, and I stopped because the way Ramon puts a barrier, I said, why don't we all, I thought, okay, I could put the children of the Bracero program. Us, we rally, we do this, we do that. We put pressure on the government of Mexico and to return money. And because at one time they did get some money, but the government of Mexico promised money back, but they have to return. So, but they had to go all the way to Mexicali. And I said, well, why are they sending them their restitution of money to the United States? Because these are Braceros del Norte that live here now. I said, maybe we put, I was just, my mind was rolling, put these kids, you know, these adult kids now to work and rally and protest. There's nobody really like me. They don't give up.
Mal was just thinking that maybe they don't care because they don't know the history.
Could be, but you know, they seem like, if you're in this country, and you've gone, the children of the men that I've talked to, they've gone to school. And even those schools, you're right, schools neglect to tell you the history unless you're in a university, even universities. I don't remember hearing about this.
Me either.
Right?
Unless they're taking Chicano Studies program or something.
There's not a lot of books written about
this. No, there isn't.
So maybe that's a reason they don't see how critical, how important, or how the government cheated our parents.
Right.
And then a lot of kids are just selfish, like, oh, whatever, Dad. They don't make a effort to try to find out. Come on. I didn't know I made an effort to find it. It took like an hour, just go online and find out.
That's really sad. And I thought, you know, that's probably one of the challenges of this database. Since Brazilians are dying off, how would we know how to, like, get their permission if their kids don't care.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's not.
Nobody really cares if they're related to Bracero or.
Yeah, it's or like, not. Oh, it whatever. Like that. They don't see it as anything significant, I guess. It's sad. Maybe there's more people like me that we just don't know them. I don't know.
Hopefully. Mm-hmm. You know. That's sad.
Sad, lost history.
So yeah. And this is a good thing where students come in to play. Because we're taking the place of the Bracero's children. We care about the Bracero history. We're keeping the memories living. We're keeping that living. You know, it's what I find about, you know, the Holocaust today.
Oh, my God.
It's not really mentioned. Like, the history is not really mentioned. The slavery in the U.S. totally forgot about.
Yeah.
It's just, even with this generation of African Americans, they don't even know who the Black Panthers are. Or Mumia, or,
right,
you know?
Yeah, it's because
nobody ever tells them.
Yeah, and you know what's funny? Because I'm an educator, and I teach geography and culture, and I teach history, I'm a social science teacher, I make it a point, because if you look at a text, there's like a little paragraph on slavery. Okay, and that's our U.S. history books.
I remember that, and my history book said that slavery was in the 1700s all the way until, like, 1820 or 1900
yeah,
or whatever,
yeah.
or something. But that's not the truth.
No, and then they don't mention anything. You know, I didn't learn this till more about slavery when I got to Mentor College. I went to Mentor College for a couple of years. Ola Washington. I don't know if you did. You go to Mentor College? Just straight to Cal State.
I went there for like. Mm-hmm. I was taking a history class this summer, but I dropped it.
Yeah, there was an instructor, Ola Washington, professor, I would say. She talked, I took African histories and African American mm-hmm. histories, and she said that one of the things that she did in her studies is go look at the Emancipation Proclamation and the transcripts that took place when Abe Lincoln was going to mm-hmm. sign it. He didn't want to sign it. He was for slavery,
right.
not only because it benefited him. He had slaves in his home,
right.
but he did it as a political move. So a lot of kids are like, oh, Abe Lincoln, we have him on a penny. I talked to him about the truth, not my opinions, because I'm not there to form their opinion. I said, this is the truth. This is what happens. You don't hear about slavery. And I see the way my two black students, because we talked about the flight of the African Americans, they're embarrassed to hear that because they don't hear it enough in their histories. And that's sad. And, you know, this is in relation to the bracero. We don't hear about it.
No, we don't.
No one tells you.
No.
So that's where people like me come around.
Right.
You're an educator. You tell
right.
your students. You don't form an opinion, but you tell them
right.
the facts.
Right, people like you and Alamillo, mm-hmm. like with you and Alamillo. Mm-hmm. Alamillo doesn't, he teaches us, like, he doesn't really teach us, like, a theory in Chicano studies. Mm-hmm. He doesn't, immigration or the Bracero program. He gives us these books, all these different theories.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, this is the truth, this is what happened, and mm-hmm. here's the theories behind it, why it happened.
Mm-hmm.
You read these books, you do the assignments, and you come up with your own theories.
Yeah, right. And, mm-hmm.
or your own opinion, and
that's what teaching is about.
It
facilitate. You don't intend to mold their minds of what your opinions are, because mine are completely
right.
different.
And I was thinking about like math, like all math is just like teach your kids 2 + 2 = 4. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
I want to be like, they say, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. Now everybody says that's a fact, but I want you to find out. I want you to prove that wrong. I want you to say, no, 2 + 2 = 6. I want you to tell me why you think it's 6.
Because
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you could be right, because there's no wrong answers. And by the way, everybody gets an A in this class. I don't care how bad you do it. That'll be me, you know?
Analytical thinking, yeah.
Yeah.
There's universities, no grades. So you got but there's like they ask you for your transcripts. Oh, sorry. What, you want to go to medical school? You got no GPA?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think this history needs to be. That's why it's in the Smithsonian. So that
mm-hmm.
why it's
mm-hmm.
can be
yeah.
generations after generations. And wow. So any final thoughts of like you know, on the Bracero program?
Just being an adult and being an educator, I make an emphasis to teach my kids about the Bracero
mm-hmm.
program too, especially when we talk
good.
About population shifts and the
yeah.
need of after World War II for workers, women coming into the working environment, not sufficient enough work power. I toss it in there. It's not in the text. And it's not in their standards, you know, content standards, geography standards. They don't have room for that. You got to, in geography, you have to teach these standards by this time, benchmark, because we're going to have a test and the state's going to test us. Not analytical thinking, nothing with the real world.
When I was taking a geography class in community college for my A degree, the instructor was like, you know, he used to be a hippie. He was still a protester. He was like in the like 50s at that time, 50s or 60s. He was really awesome. But in his geography class, which I only stayed in it for like a couple of weeks, all we did was learn about the geography or
physical geography.
Mm-hmm. And then like where this country is, where that country mm-hmm. is, what makes up the. And then there's also like, or was it geology? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. There was, regardless of if it was geology or geography, there was like never like you know how weather affects people or, you know why they had to build levees in New Orleans or there was never that aspect and what happens with in case something if like there's an earthquake that happens like this region is by next to the Pacific Ring of Fire, what happens when there's a lack of protections, lack of you know, earthquake-proof buildings, what happens to the people there.
So the human impact.
Yeah.
You know, this is geography, and one of the themes is, geographers put down standards.
Yeah.
And it says the human and physical characteristics of, and then, of course, a country. And I focus on the human characteristics, but that's what history is about. And you can't not connect geography with history.
And geology with history, too.
Geology, because those are the forces, the natural forces
right.
that shape and change
right.
us, or we change and change our environment in order
right.
to pursue our, or to meet our needs. And that's,
right.
you know, we go into deforestation, the,
right.
all that other stuff, the impact on the environment.
Right.
So geography has a lot to do with all that stuff.
Right.
So
exactly.
It branches out to a lot of stuff.
Exactly. I'm going to ask you about your living arrangements when you're growing up. So you stayed in this country when you were growing up, or did you travel to Mexico every once in a while?
No, I was never that type of person
okay.
because we had ties to the United States. My mother was an American citizen. So we weren't those early immigrants where I know I see it now with my own students. They go to Mexico. Whenever my father wanted to see his mother, he would go see her. And also the fact economic factor. Let's say they wanted to take us. They can't afford to take a bunch of kids.
Right.
So they took my brother and sister a couple of times to visit my grandma when she was alive. I've never met my grandma.
Mm.
So, no, we weren't that type of migrating to Mexico back and forth. We had our roots. We stayed here in the United States. This is our home.
Mm.
So our living arrangements, we lived here, basically. We went to school. We had our allegiance to the United States, let me just tell you. Very patriotic person also.
Did you, do you think that was like a loss of your Mexicanness?
Not connecting to my roots?
Yeah.
Later on, yes. And that's why when I was old enough, I took that pledge to find my roots. I went, my brother and I went, and we said, we want to know what Zacatecas is like, where my father grew up, because there's that dual thing also that we talked about. When you're a person mixed blood, but also when you're a Chicana, you're not accepted by the whites because, hey, you're brown, you're from a different culture, you're not accepted from the Mexicans because I have been told I'm Malinche, a traitor, by an educator. Malinche, it was a guy, that's the way Mexicans see us. So we don't fit into either one of that. The best piece in a movie, movies sometimes just, they're fantasy. Selena, when Olmos is saying what the experiences of a Chicano, you don't fit here, you don't fit there. So I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to go to Mexico, and this is where I probably fit, because you always feel like you don't fit here in the United States, even though you're an American, a Chicana. And so I went to find my roots, and I found out I was completely disappointed. That was not my hometown. That is not my home. They let me know I'm an outsider in Mexico. I am not part of Mexico. And that's okay, because we found our niche here, the Chicanos. So it was a rude awakening for me. I thought, ooh, of course the people in Mexico, in the hometown of where my father lived, oh, they loved us there. We were family, of course, you know. They were really accepting. My aunt even cried when I left the Rio. He was born Rio Grande, Zacatecas. Everybody in the little town knew us when we came. Oh, Mr. Jose's daughter is here and her son. You know, we were like celebrities there. But the reality is, we were even in a restaurant one time when they refused to serve us in Mexico City.
So the people who were close to your parents accepted you, like they were.
That's the family, yes.
The family,
the town, mm-hmm.
the town, but
yes.
Outside of the town, or they
no,
didn't know.
No, Mexicans don't like. They call us pochos. They don't like us.
Wow.
They, as I mentioned, that incident where I was at a conference, an educators conference in San Diego. San Marcos University, and they invited some people from TJ educators who were having a workshop, and we came into the conversation of feelings on how they feel about Americans or Chicanos, and the guy says, first he says, oh, we're fine with it, and then he stopped and looked at me because he knew I was looking for the truth. He goes, no, we see you as traitors. We call you the Malinche. I said, you're very wrong. I said, during the civil rights movement, you know, the Chicano movimiento, we're fighting for the rights of our people. I'm still doing that because, you know what, I'm an educator and I'm educating our kids. I'm still at the barrio. Because I worked in Colonia in junior high. I could choose anywhere else to work, but I choose there. So these people don't accept us, these people.
It's about survival, I think. Yeah. In Alamillo's Chicano Studies history class, took last fall, where the first book was, we wrote as Mamanatsin, La Malinche. And the book was saying, no, she's not a traitor. It was arguing that she's not a traitor. She had to do this for survival. She knew several different languages. She knew Nahua, Spanish, Mayan. I don't know if she knew English. I'm not too sure. But she knew, several languages. She is not a traitor. She had to do it because she was forced.
Forced. But others look at it like she didn't have to do it. She would have lost her life, and that's just like being a prisoner of war, right?
Right.
You could either lose your life or give out your whole platoon or lose your life. Which one?
Right.
So I guess a different perspective you could think either way.
Right.
Right?
We still think that in Mexico that
yes, this was
the
an
majority
educated,
of them.
This was an educated man, an educated Mexican. These people had this academic language that even I didn't understand because I was born here and I didn't go to school in Mexico. My vocabulary is not as extended in Spanish language. I speak Spanish to get along.
Wow.
It's not academic. My English is a lot better than Spanish. My writing skills.
Wow.
Even being bilingual. It's more an oral thing.
And that's the same with Monatine. She knew several different languages, not just Nahua, and that's probably the reason why they viewed her as a traitor is because she adopted other languages, and in the Chicanos' case, they adopted English over Spanish
To survive.
To survive,
especially we were born in the time where you got beat,
right?
Or you couldn't talk that language. Well, I'm gonna drop it then. I don't want to be Mexican because it's a survival thing. But then again. You wise up, not everybody, and say, heck no, I'm not going to let that happen. The hell with it, I'll fight the system. And that's it, that's be my case. And so, so I did go, but it wasn't, Mexico was not patriotic to us like it is to some of the immigrants. Cause I work with these kids that they didn't want to stand and do the Pledge of Allegiance of the United States. Because to them, they saw this country as... someone that has done them wrong. I said, no, I kiss the ground that I walk in because this is a country that has taken care of me. Mexico hasn't gotten their you-know-what together ever since the revoluciones and everything going on. Still, corrupt government. And that's how I feel. I don't, it's funny because someone that doesn't know that is white will see me, and it's funny, my husband saw me that way. Saw me as a paisa. They don't know the difference. See, people, right? And I know that maybe you might find that derogatory, but it's someone that is born in Mexico and has patriotism towards Mexico. I don't. Why would I? I've never
exactly.
been except for one time.
Exactly.
So my allegiance to the United States.
Wow.
This is where I live, democratic country. I'm a Chicana.
When you go to Veracruz or Chiapas or, deep down where the indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
So they're more accepting of, they love Monatsin for what she did, and they're more accepting of the Chicano movement because the Chicano support the Zapatistas.
Those that know.
Some
educate. Some people don't know the difference. They just see outsiders. Like I said, the pocho, you're trading here.
Wow.
Your roots. Why would I trade? I never had roots over there.
Right? Exactly.
This is a new
exactly. That's, wow.
People.
Wow. Because, the Anglo-American Society just lumps, Mexicans all together.
Saw me.
Permanent immigrant group.
Yeah, that's how my husband saw it. It's funny because he said, I thought you were a paisa. That's derogatory when you hear, a paisa means you're a hillbilly Mexican, right?
Right.
I thought you were a bisa, that your sister spoke more English. What do you mean? I'm an educated woman. What are you talking about? Because he hears my accent. I don't hear my accent, but you know, you hear my accent. I speak Spanish, so therefore I have an accent. So he saw me. That's why I explained to him, too. You guys see us as all the same. No, I had to explain. Now he understands. I still get him for that.
Just because somebody has the color of skin does not make them that same nationality.
Yes, exactly. That's not my nationality. First of all, I was born in the United States. I mean, my mother was born in the United States. Even my mother was real patriotic to the United States. That's just the way we were. My father, on the other hand, if you read the word, I recommend you read the book Bocho if you haven't already. That's my father right there. My father has pledged his allegiance to Mexico as kids that I have been my students and refused to do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right, because he's Mexican. That's where he was raised.
Yeah. And I would think that you would change your ways, because I've known people that have said, well, I mean, this country's given me a lot. I work here. I pay my taxes. You know, I pledge allegiance. So, you know, Mexico came out with that dual citizenship thing. I can get that dual citizenship, but I said, why would I? Why would I want to go to Mexico? I got to find out about our politicians. So anyways, because I can become a dual citizen, you know that, because of my father born in Mexico. I said, why would I want to become? First, we thought about it because for the sense of buying property there as like a retirement home. I said, I'm going to live in Mexico. I'm busy. I'm afraid.
Wow. So, yeah. So even like it's funny, but since there's this continuing Mexican immigration and Central American immigration, there's going to be always closer familial ties to, you know, because immigrants marry, you know, second or third generation Mexican Americans here, and there's always going to be that direct lineage.
Yeah, of some kind of connection to Mexico, but I really didn't. I don't know how. Okay, I have aunts and uncles that I'm sure will be happy to see me. I was 20 years old when I first went over there, and I do have a cultural connection, but not a connection to the country itself.
You know, whereas like with the European migration, that
you lose a connection. Yeah. I mean, how many could you trace your?
No, I can't. It's all because of these immigration laws, you know. Because these laws and policies stopped European migration, but then the free trade programs are continuing. They're forcing the migration from Mexico and Central America to keep coming to here, and so there's other factors that cause immigration to the U.S. from Mexico and Central America, but you know, I'm glad, in a way, I'm glad that the government stopped European migration, because I didn't want, they thought, okay, we have enough white people already, we don't, no more population. But you know, I'm kind of like angry about that, because I have no direct relatives in England or Ireland. Yeah. It's foreign. Like when I go to a British store in downtown Ventura, that's foreign to me, and it shouldn't be foreign.
Yeah,
but it is, because of these immigration laws that happen.
Yes.
You know,
exactly.
So when you go to a Mexican restaurant, that's not foreign to you, because
I still eat the food because
of
my mother.
Yeah, and then the immigrants are continuing to, like, you know, they're replenishing. They're replenishing your
ethnicity. Have you read or heard of the book La Conquista, the Reconquista? A white guy that wrote
Conquista,
a book down. Reconquest.
We're
out there trying to conquer.
Yeah.
But I understand your feeling, and that's the reason that I try to emphasize, I said in class, that you have a lineage. It's just we started with this mentality of the melting pot, and you know, it's unfortunate, because you seek to find an identity still.
Right. And it's good for Mexican Americans here, because, in a way, immigration is good, because it instills their ethnicity. It, replenishes it, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, but in a way, it's bad, because Anglo-American society lumps them together.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. And you know, I'm glad I'm hearing you, or it's nice. I'm learning from you, because I have a white. My husband has a white brother-in-law. He's a doctor in Washington. One time he said, I love Mexico. I wish I were Mexican. And I'm thinking, when you're Mexican, you suffer a lot of biases. It's easier being a white man. It is. And then he said, except being black. I wouldn't want to be black. And because it's difficult being a black man. Even now, you walk in a, you know, you're walking sideways and you see other people walk away from it because they're afraid of black people. It's hard being a black man. Harder than being a Latina.
It is, because especially when you're a black person here, you're a born citizen.
Yes.
Here, but you're still not seen as a citizen.
Yeah, isn't that funny? And you still, and that's why my kids, I see in their faces, they're embarrassed when I talk about the African slave trade. That they came from that existence, that they were forced into slavery.
And then, you know what's sad is that not just the American government, but the first world governments made them and the schools made them forget their ancestors. What if they're from a tribe in Africa, or their family's from Jamaica, or they're Afro mestizos?
Yes.
What if there's some black people? There's black people in Mexico.
Yeah, they're like you in a sense that they don't have an identity.
Right.
But it's worse because they're seen with dark skin.
Right.
At least you can be.
I feel that.
I know
I
shouldn't. I shouldn't say that.
No, I feel that. I totally understand. I think that's wrong. I also think it's wrong that for Mexicans to be their Chicano brothers and sisters as traitors. Mm-hmm. I think that's wrong.
Yeah, they don't see us as
I don't think authentic. There's really no authentic anywhere because people change.
You know, there's a, just with that, there's a song with Gloria Estefan says, we're all brothers, even if you're Latino. Like, the Puerto Ricans don't like to be told they're Mexican. It's funny.
It is true.
Like, oh my, I'm not Mexican. I'm from El Salvador.
It's true.
And white
it's
people
true.
See them as all the same.
All Latinos. All the same. But it's not true. Really. It's not. Yeah, we just got to take our time and get to know them and interview them like I'm doing you.
Yeah.
Mm. So how did you feel about your mother and father while growing up?
Embarrassed. I was embarrassed that my father worked in the fields. I was embarrassed that my mother was a Mexican woman. And this is mean to say that she was a big woman. She was a big woman because she was pregnant. She had a big abdomen. So I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed of the way they looked. But you know what? The thing is, now I know as a parent, doesn't matter the way you look, is you're embarrassed because you're a teenager. My kids are embarrassed of me. They've always didn't want me around their school, but I was embarrassed and ashamed that my father and parents were Mexican farm workers. I was. Because there's no pride in it when people look down at you. Not anymore, of course.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. And how do you feel about them now?
Oh, shoot. My mother, I put in a pedestal. She worked so hard. I'm just looking back in her life, and how could she even handle 12 kids? I had a hard time handling 3 kids. And what she went through and how she came, her family first, even the ancestors, how they, my mother tells me that they came through the Sierra Madre to San Bernardino in a wagon. And how they suffered over there, but they were able to establish themselves, and they had, her grandfather was able to own land, and they grew grapes. There's this really awesome movie about people, Mexicans in the United States growing grapes. So they improved their life. My mother, my grandma going to high school and knowing English, my mother says that when they were in Mexico, they went back, that my grandma used to have class for people so they could learn English, and she had all these books. My sister, my older sister, said, I remember my grandma having all these books in a bookshelf, and I never asked, and I wonder, wow, look at all these books. She was a well-learned woman, my grandma. And so that's the reason my mom resented. She missed all the opportunities. My mom went to school up to the 3rd grade, and the reason she went to 3rd grade is because my grandmother had come back to Mexico to follow a man that was at that time working with Pancho Villa and was a Rolling Stone. Wherever he lay his hat was his home. And so my grandma was in love with her husband, but you know, my mom found out later on she had half-brothers somewhere else. And he used to rob trains. Worked for Pancho Villa, but that's not what killed him. You know what killed him was he was seeing a woman that was married. The husband killed him.
Oh.
So, and he was a big, big man with a sombrero on a horse. And even my father says, when I had to ask for your mother's hand, The tradition is you ask your padrino, the man that baptized you, go ask for the hand in marriage to that house, ask the father. That padrino said, no, mijo, I ain't going with you. Everybody feared el señor, his name was Isabel Martinez. Everybody feared Isabel Martinez.
Wow.
I can imagine this big old man. Corrote,
oh, wow.
Jalisco. I don't know. I just imagine him, you know. So, where did I go with it? How did I get to that story?
Oh, yeah, you're asking about your, I don't know, but it's just story.
How did I get away from here?
I was just going to comment on, about your mom's family owning land. And.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so what was the question, though?
Where was that land exactly?
Oh, in San Bernardino.
Is it still there? Or is it?
Not anymore. They sold it. It was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I have relatives over there. I don't know. They're long-lost relatives.
I grew up in Redlands. And I used to go to... I was born in San Bernardino. And I moved to Redlands when I was two. So it's interesting to know that there's a really...
Yeah, there's relatives
history.
Over there. I don't know. They visited one time while I was young. These relatives, but my mom. Well, my mom had her aunts. Their aunts living because they were raised there. They stayed, except for the sister. My grandma Petra. She came to visit her, follow her man, because she got married in San Bernardino. Because he was in horseback everywhere. You know, the Pancho Villa was in the United States a lot, so they were over there. The Villistas, and so that's where my grandma met my father, my grandpa.
That's so cool that Pancho was, like, you know, in San Bernardino.
It's
exciting.
Yeah.
Lots of history.
Yeah, it's a lot of history.
Pancho Villa in San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Dad, I don't know. Pancho Villa must have been there. He had his men. Unless his men went somewhere else.
Speaking of the revolution, it was, like, drawing connections to the Pasito program. As we all know, after the revolution, the PRI took charge of, you know, the
political party. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The Revolutionary Party of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
They claimed to be for the poor because they were bought in because of the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking myself, well, if that was the case, if they were in charge during the 40s and in the 40s, I mean. Then why did they agree to this Presidio program if they were
it's corrupt and they benefited from it. That's why, because Mexico doesn't know how to take care of its people. You know, one of the Braceros made this comment when we were watching the film. He said, you know why they treated us the way they treated us? Because Mexico, the man said, I don't remember what his man was, he says, I'm not mad at the United States. I'm mad at Mexico for allowing this to happen. He said, Filipinos were there. They got paid better because their country didn't allow them to be abused like Mexico. Mexico allowed it. Because you're in such extreme poverty, I guess you do whatever it takes to move up. Like, we know 10% of whatever's owned in Mexico is the rich, right?
10% just like here, riches. 20%, 80%.
No middle class in Mexico. I mean... Still going on. I mean, that's
The revolution never really changed this.
Nothing changed. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. And you think about history, and I talk about it with the kids. How different would it have been in Hitler? Because Hitler had asked Mexico for help to fight during World War II, and the only reason that Mexico nothing happened is because the telegram was lost. There was a telegram that he sent over
Mexico. Wow, really? And it was lost.
It was lost. And he was asking Mexico to side with. Imagine Germany would have then taken over Mexico. And President Polk wanted to start a revolution, wanted to take over Mexico, too. There's documents that show he wanted at one time.
Wow, yeah. Because
history would have changed. And you know what? I'm not being a patriotic Mexico. I said, maybe that's what we... Somebody take over that. Because look, it's still a big mess, and we're in the 21st century.
That's really interesting. That would have been really...
We're in the 21st century, and nothing has... What has changed? What has changed for the poor people in Mexico?
You know, not saying Hitler was a really bad person, not defending him, but
yeah,
He did change Germany. He made their nationalism was strong. The state was weak, but the nationalism was really strong because of him, and people were identified as Germans. Mm-hmm. And that's really important for
patriotism, yeah. Nationalism, patriotism, but only it was in the hands of the wrong man.
Exactly.
One.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, you know, you have to, and then, of course, we have the people that deny the Holocaust ever happening, right. So that's another issue.
But what would have happened if Mexico said, yes, we'll help you?
Imagine what would have happened.
We would have probably white farmers today, white farm workers today. Yeah.
Because, you know, Hitler would have tried to eliminate all the Mexicans. One student said, or he would have tried to kill all the Mexicans because he believed in one supreme race. And he was
the white race.
Yeah, and he was making, he had his baby factories of the white races. Right,
right. And then once he, because he and Japan were working together, if we didn't win against Japan, then Japan would have, Hitler would have moved into Japan, mm-hmm. got rid of the Japanese.
Yeah, but he wanted to conquer the whole world.
He would have, yeah. He was doing a good job.
He would have got Mexico with no problem. No problem. They don't have an army. We kind of army.
Wow. So close of being screwed over by the Germans.
I would have been German.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It really would have changed the world. I mean,
yeah.
He was on his way of conquering the whole world.
Yes, he was. That's what he wanted to do. And he would have succeeded because Germany had an excellent army. They kept conquering a lot of the countries.
Yeah, he would have if he didn't invade the Soviets.
Yeah.
But he did. Yeah. The Soviets got him. Wow. Interesting. Interesting how the Brasoto program would have never happened if it wasn't for the telegram being lost.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You should look that up. That's interesting. When I found that, it's in the books, in the history books.
Wow. Wow, it's interesting. Mm. Yeah. Wow. I'm going to ask you some final reflections mm-hmm. about the program. What do you think of the Brasoto program when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I didn't know about the Brasoto program. I didn't know. They never taught in school. I just maybe heard my dad say that he had been in the States, having lived in Mexico. So I don't have. I didn't think anything about it. I didn't know about it.
And what do you think of it now?
Oh, Mexican people got screwed over and to the benefit of a corrupt government and still exist. Like I said, you're talking to a person not patriotic Mexico at all because I don't have a reason to be. And more so because it's screwed up my family and everybody that lived there. And it still is. And still things have not changed. When I went to visit when I was 20 to Mexico, my relatives still live in poverty. They didn't even have a toilet. I had to go in the bathroom corral. No showers. No. I mean, come on. To have a country in that time was the 20th century, and you don't even have running water for your people. What's going on?
Do you blame NAFTA for that, or do you blame? Can two countries have a free trade program?
Oh, well, NAFTA wasn't going on back then, but now, and I teach about NAFTA, and I know that NAFTA, and there's this really good documentary put up by PBS on the effects of NAFTA, and they were talking about South Mexico, 40% of people still living in poverty after NAFTA. So the free trade agreement has not been doing what it was intended to do. Did not. So, has anything happened because of NAFTA? No. Corporations have benefited because of NAFTA.
American corporations. Yeah,
that's it.
That's it.
And the same things that were going on in the Industrial Revolution, the 1800s, are going on because of NAFTA. Child labor laws.
Yep.
The wages, working conditions. It's like history is repeating itself.
Yep.
But we're letting it happen in another country.
Yeah.
So my feelings about NAFTA? It didn't work. It's not working, but it's still in existence. And then what's this deal about Mexican trucks not being able to come to the United States and deliver their goods? But Canada is. I mean, no, it's not working. And being an educator, it teaches that. I tell the kids, these are the facts, and I showed them that video. It was fact. It was in my, but my feelings are it's not benefiting the people. Even though some people were interviewed said, well, at least I have food on the table. That's not all we want. We don't want at least food on the table. you're still immigrating to the United States because your country's so screwed up. If NAFTA would have done what it was set to do, we wouldn't have that issue of this influx of immigrants coming in here. Because I have a different feeling about immigration, too. I think Mexico has to take care of their people. I mean, I don't blame the United States for having regulations. We have to take care of the people who are here now and make it better. So, no, it didn't work. We have to work. Do I believe in maybe another program going on, like the Bracero, to help out Mexico? Canada's involved. They have a Bracero program. As a matter of fact, my relatives, my cousins, are going to Canada to work. They have a program, a Bracero. I haven't heard anything bad going on. Not that I researched it, or it's just fairly new again. I mean, how is it? Sometimes we need to look back or look around and see how are other countries succeeding? I mean, immigration is such a issue in every country. Europe is having the same problems of immigrants from third world countries coming in. So, NAFTA did not sit up to do what it wanted to. So I have real strong opinions about this because it's so close to home. Mm-hmm. I see it with my relatives. They're still poor.
Hmm. How did what happened to your father after the program ended?
That was a few years after my mom realized she had to do something. I contacted her with her tia Francisca in San Bernardino, knew she was an American citizen, packed all the family, went to TJ so they could be closer. She passed over to the United States legally because she was born in San Bernardino, and she earned enough money to get everybody's documents, processing fees, and brought the whole family over. So it was the end of the Bracero program, and then he was a farm worker here in the United States until he landed his job in CalTurf, which was a sod farm he worked for many years. Hmm. So they did work in the fields, in the Oxnard fields and Salinas. Hmm. Never heard from Bracero program again.
Wow.
And my dad was the lucky one, because his brothers and sisters were still out there trying to get, when they heard about that 10%, trying to get the money from the government of Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah, real sure. No. You can tell the way
it's
I'm talking.
It's a tough fight. The Mexican government is really tough, tougher than the U.S. government. That's what I think. Uh-huh. Really corrupt.
Yeah.
At least you don't have these, like, you know, drug lords taking over our towns in Los Angeles.
Oh, my God. That's one reason I tell my dad when I go visit you.
It's a lawless state.
Yeah.
It's not even a state. It's a lawless society.
Yeah, it's like we were in the Wild West time. Still going on. I mean, I go visit my dad and you see these guys with a bandana and military and a gun standing there on the roadside, you know, going towards Ensenada. These are their military, but they're probably in cahoots with the drug lords, you know.
Probably.
Scary country.
It is. You got two fights going. It's got the drug fight going on. It's also got the indigenous fight going on.
Yeah, the indigenous and the economic problem that they continue to have throughout all these years. Poor Mexico.
It's not just NAFTA. It's like, you know.
No,
goes
not
back
just NAFTA.
All the way. And then, like, NAFTA just made it worse, but it just goes back all the way.
NAFTA didn't help.
Yeah, it didn't help at all. Just can't blame the U.S. for the immigration problem. I'm not sure if it's a problem, but.
Issue, I guess we call it the issue
of immigration, but you just got to blame both governments.
Mm-hmm.
Doing their.
Yeah, because the United States is benefiting. I mean, we're
where are we in agriculture? Benefiting from it, yeah.
I mean, we're our economy is booming because of our agriculture. I mean, how much money do we make? I've forgotten. I see it all the time.
It's like the second leading industry in America.
Yeah, and I just saw that show recently, and you probably saw it with the immigration, the immigrant kids working out in the fields as we speak. There was a 2020, I think, special. I don't remember what it was. They had the kids from Oaxaca. Most of them are indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the Mexicans, hardly. They go to the service. And it's funny how they could still work there. I have students whose mother, undocumented, are working in Olive Garden. I mean, come on. You still, see, you're against immigration, but you're hiring them.
And are you paying them the way you're supposed to? And are they getting the health benefits? We don't know. I don't know. We go, you know. So all these companies are benefiting from labor. So you think they're against immigration? Maybe on the outside, but, you know, right? Shoot. It's like a... No, we can go on. It's kind of gets you, this whole issue gets you going.
Yeah, it does. It does.
It's like,
you know, it, yeah.
We can go on and on. Yeah. I think we branched out into immigration all of a sudden.
Well, it is related to the.
I know it is.
Because there's, you know.
It's such a hot topic. It only even gets me pissed off just.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. So, and how did the program affect your life, the Bezetto program?
How did it affect my life? It didn't affect my life. It affected the life of my family, because maybe I think if my family didn't continue to be in poverty, maybe I wouldn't be here, because my mom wouldn't have sought help from her aunt saying, hey, help me, I'm in poverty. Mm-hmm. After supposedly my father working for 5 years, and it was the same thing.
Wow.
So I think that it affected my family in the sense that poverty still existed, so therefore they sought other avenues or my mother sought other avenues to help support the family. So I think that's in that case, they said, shoot, we're not making ends meet here.
No.
Even with maybe we should go to the United States instead of just sending pops over there for 5 years and doing no, we don't know what. My mom probably was, Dad, I don't want you going over there anymore. And then my father was this good-looking man, a musician, so my mom was no stupid.
Oh.
Let her bang. You know, it's funny because
makes you think that he's a good-looking man and a musician. Like,
yeah, he probably has some brothers going on there somewhere. I don't know. Not related, are we? No.
Oh, man.
But he was out there with a gabacha, not really. I'm kidding you.
Never know. So, as you know, there's some new proposals to bring back like a new guest worker program.
Yeah, I've heard Obama, the administration talking about it, but nothing has been set in stone. So,
what do you think about that? Would you support it?
You know what? Mexico needs help, and I think that both countries have to sit down and find a way to do it. We know that the first Bracero program didn't work, so could Bugs be worked out? Perhaps we'll have to ask Canada, see how they're doing. We have to ask Canada how is it going? how are you doing? How you like them apples? How's it going on? You know, what's going on with you? So whether they have a system that they discover that works well, where they do work and then return to their country, or just some type of alliance. Economically with the other country. I certainly don't know the answer. The experts haven't figured it out, so, you know, I don't know what the answer is. But I'm saying the first one didn't work, so we have to find, work out the bugs. I don't believe in a full amnesty again, I'll tell you, as a Chicana, because I know from the insight that people that were not working, it was intended for those working in the fields, there were people making a business out of selling the letters, they call it las cartas, to bring people that had never worked in the United States to just come in, so you saw an influx of all kinds of immigrants. And that's a strain on our economy, strain on people who've been here for generations. I have to say that, and especially because I'm real strong about this, and I'm a Chicana, I believe this, and I say I'm a little bit more, even though I'm a liberal, in the sense of the way I think. You know, I saw this thing about the promise for undocumented kids. My kids don't get a free lunch. My kids, I worked here for generations, and why should a new immigrant and not my kids? Nothing's going to change for the people that live here. See how I think about that? I know maybe you might think, well, she's a Chicana, she shouldn't. No. What's happened to the my Chicano kids? Where's their promise? You know how much I'm paying for school and loans just to put my kids through college, and then we'll have the promise for the newly arrived person, and they get a free lunch? I don't think so. See how strong I am against that? I'm serious.
Yeah.
I mean, my family worked in the fields. I worked, for fun, whatever, my brothers and sisters. I'm improving the life of my children. And this country does not make it easy. It's no, hard.
It is hard.
I still have loans I have to pay.
Even hard for, you know, white people.
Yes, that's
even
what I'm
hard
saying.
For me.
So that's what I'm saying. What is it doing for? That's why I'm not
it's
anti.
Not, the Dream Act, you know, I'm not anti-immigrant mm-hmm. either.
No, me neither. No. I know we're people
right.
that
I'm pro-immigrant rights.
Yeah.
You know, you want to come here? Fine. Come
yes.
here. Illegal. Do what you
yes.
want. I don't care
yes.
if you have papers.
Uh-huh.
You should, you're a human being.
Yes.
You're human.
Yes.
You're a citizen of the world.
Uh-huh.
But the government needs to focus on,
exactly.
if they want to come here, we have to tell them, mm-hmm. okay, here's where you're going to have to face in America.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that it's going to be the same as you're,
yes.
you still have the class issues.
Mm-hmm.
There's high
yes.
racism in America.
Uh-huh.
We got to tell
yes.
the people who are coming here, like the struggle, that if you're going to come here, just know that you're going to have a struggle.
Yes,
like us.
Because you
we're
know
struggling.
What? We don't have socialized education. You want that, you go to Cuba.
Yeah.
Pastor will pay for
go
your education
Cuba.
Over there.
Yeah.
But you know what? Here, why should it become socialized for you and not for our class? No. See, I'm in the. I got mad when I saw that. As
right, because it's not being socialized for them. It's like because they still have to.
Well,
in a way,
it's a little
bit
easier. You know, they just started and
right.
they have lower wages.
Right.
I said, what are they doing for us? So
right.
We have to find some programs for
right.
people that are in the middle.
Right.
That they are in this country, been out of this country, you know, with the making of the colony, you know, but
exactly.
yeah. So there's a lot of issues that need to be worked out, because you know, we have to consider people here that have put in the system already. So.
Hmm. It's a touchy subject.
It is touchy.
It's
you know,
a touchy
so I don't
subject.
Get mad when
yeah.
people are against him because yeah. there is it's logical and I can see why.
Right.
You know, and maybe I would think different if I was I had crossed over the border yesterday.
Right.
And maybe I would think different. Like,
right.
okay, you're a country of opportunity.
Right.
Why? Give me. No, I don't think so. Wait a minute.
Because see, that's the thing. We're not a country of opportunity.
Not really.
No, we're not. And then, like, these kids who come over on trains to find the parents,
mm-hmm.
and they see all the media. They see Disneyland,
yeah,
and they
yeah,
saw
yeah.
the commercials, and ABC, NBC. But yeah. what are those countries forget to tell you? Oh, by the way, if you're white, you come into those.
Yeah.
If you're colored, you might have some trouble, because if you're colored, you're going to be like, poor the rest of your life in America.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
and
yes.
that's not what they realize. They think uh-huh. it's like, you know, it's the capital place and all the
mm-hmm.
rule. There's it's the dreams, but you know,
mm-hmm.
that's not right. It just depends how much money you have.
Yeah,
then
it's
your dreams
capitalism.
Can
we know, and you know,
right.
you might be against Marxist views, but Marxists had an idea that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
it's difficult to see all the social classes and people that struggle so hard to just stay be in the bottom. Marxists intended
yeah.
it. In the beginning, it was intended to make everything equal. It went a little wrong there somewhere. Right? Something happened. I don't see anything wrong with the initial concept of it, because
no.
we're the struggling people.
Right.
That's what's wrong with capitalism. It's not
right.
all that perfect, you know?
Right.
Anyway, that's another
subject. Right. Yeah, it's another. But it's also related to the Bosetta program. It is.
But, you know, those are
it is. Things. Yeah. I don't want, like, any CIAs to track us down.
This is going so
probably.
Oh, no.
We can edit that out.
Okay, yes, do. That was
yeah,
I off the record.
Yeah, I'm for the capitalism. We're both for capitalism. We just want to reform capitalism, make it better.
Yeah, well, at least we're not in the 50s, so we're going to get the Red Scare.
Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, so.
I'm still capitalist.
You are aware of the missing 10%, so do you think that we'll eventually find the missing 10%?
No. No, Mexico even has not. Mexico's not giving them the money. How can the world can you calculate what someone has earned, and then calculate how much interest they've accrued over the years? I mean, to pay every individual, they can't do that. It's going to be so. It's difficult. And then of course, individual never maybe came for a month and is getting paid the same that someone that wears a Bracero for 20 years. I mean, so they can't really calculate, how are they going to calculate what to pay individually every person? And so, therefore, how much money really went into the Mexican system? Who knows? Who spent it? Who knows? The world may never know. Like like Tootsie Pop, how many licks? Have you ever seen that commercial? How many licks
mm-hmm.
does it take? The world may never know. No is my answer.
Or my opinion. Oh. We might not see it. We don't know where it went.
Hmm. But do you, in these ex-Bracetos want to keep, you know, protesting in front of, like, you know, BART marches and doing these campaigns? Do you feel like they should continue them? Do you think we should tell them stop?
Or? Oh, well, you know what? I really haven't seen a lot of big news about all this. That's a problem with it. It really isn't out there in the media because, you know, people are occupied with other things. I don't think it's out there as much as it should. So
yeah.
I don't see anybody protesting right here. Once in a while, you will hear, right?
Right, right.
Should they stop? Of course not. Of course right. not. A wrong must be corrected. A wrong. And whether it's done, it's impossible to know who took the money. Thing is, they took the money. There's records that show they have it. So should we stop? No. But is it going to stop? Yes, it is, unfortunately, because the vessels are dying off. The vessels are dying off. Unfortunately, it's going to stop. Right?
Right. Like with me and being involved, you know, yeah. Hopefully I have several years left of me. Mm-hmm. But then, and 20 years from now, no more Bracetos will
no,
be left.
No more Bracetos. No more. My dad's in his 90s. He can croak anytime, right?
And then that, with that being said, is that, like, yeah, you're interested in some historical thing. What's the point? Like, the point is that I knew some of them, and I know their mm-hmm. offspring, and I want justice. Are you going to help me? Yeah. No, that's history.
Yeah,
who cares about history?
Yeah. It's
and that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like the Native Americans. They lost their lands. Nazis isn't going to give them anything back. They never will. Canada did. Did you hear it? Canada returned some of the land back to the Native Americans. Yes, they did.
Awesome.
Yes, they did. Will Mexico? I mean, this is another US topic, but no. And then the African Americans were asking for...
They're 10%. Yeah, they're the money that they lost, too, yeah.
Yeah, as slaves. What about all the time they
the worked sharecropping
as slaves,
and,
right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Working for free as slaves.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Jewish people, everything they did, they lost. Some of them has been given back.
Yeah.
It's just sad the way history is, and then it takes people like us to continue the struggle.
It is.
Whatever that may be and what avenue.
Yeah.
So, no.
So what do you think that needs to be done to seek justice for ex-Bracetos?
Letting the media know that the struggle is still going on, writing books, articles on what history and what happened, including that in our schools, that this did take place. So the knowledge that this happened, start from there, and of course... The pressures on the politicians to keep that in their agendas. It might not be a hot ticket like immigration or some other thing, especially when it's time for voting to take place. But that's the only way to do it. Pressure on politicians and people knowing the history.
And going, when you went to the Bracetos exhibit, you saw. Copy of like the original contract on the mm-hmm. on the display board, mm-hmm. and it was policy versus practice. Policy was a great bill, you know, gave the workers rights and everything, mm-hmm. but policy was never enforced because mm-hmm. of public versus private.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think? Like I was looking at the ag. Have you had a chance to look at the ag jobs bill?
No.
It provides, like, stronger, like, this really strong bill that's stronger than the Bracetos agreement. It would give them, like, you know, it would allow them to attorneys in case the mm-hmm. growers would, you know, violate their rights and the growers would have to pay their attorney fees.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Do you think that would be actually carried out, or do you think the same injustices in the Bracetos program will happen in a new guest worker program?
Well, the possibilities always exist of things going wrong because to humanist to error, as long as the people are, and when money is involved in an economy. The possibility does exist that things could go wrong. Now, would it be carried out? It's up to who runs a program. How important are those people and are they going to carry it out? I would hope that it would.
Our conversation will be stored in the Smithsonian forever so that generations after generations of people can learn about this important part of U.S. Mexican history. Would you like to have some last words before we end our interview?
Just important to keep alive the history of what went on. And of course, in my case, because I'm an educator, that's a struggle that I continue with in an individual basis, even though it's not part of our curriculum. Historians are important, and especially for first generations, to include that in the books that they do write, because several books have already written. And we can't allow for this aspect of history to repeat itself. We learn from history in order to not repeat the past, but to move forward and plan for a better future. And I hope that things like this, events like this, give us insight into what could possibly go wrong when there's a pursuit for in this case, economic gain. Just to see it as a learning event, as any other historical event that's occurred in history and life. So that's it.
Thank you.
Whenever it happened again, and now, I mean, not in at least people like your generation that are coming up, and are those people that are out there marching, and right?
We're very,
I don't think you guys would allow it. You're the
some
new
of us
generation.
Are very skeptical about the Ag Jobs Bill, and.
Yeah.
Now that we know the Becerra program, and
you vote, your voters, and you know, your people that are pretty much aware of what goes on, and you know, Latino, the what they call the sleeping giant is waking up.
Mm-hmm.
I hope goes back to sleep sometimes.
But you know, it's interesting. I know more history of the Chicano movement, the Chicano history, than some Chicanos today do.
It's
interesting.
Just,
yeah.
That's the thing. It's the opportunity to educate oneself, and not this country does not allow everybody to do so. We don't all have the opportunity. I did, from my brothers and sisters, just a few of us have college degrees. Two. We don't have the opportunity. So, you know, how else are you going to disseminate or have that history if they don't go to school for it? How, I don't know, put up, make movies, media, right? So, that's about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Leticia.
All right.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I learned a lot from you.
Okay, any way I can assist you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Of course, I went,